Hey everyone, I'm Derek Lawrence.
And I'm Chanel Berlin Johnson.
And we're the hosts of Entertainment Weekly's brand new Binge podcast, where we'll be talking about every single film in the Fast saga.
What you're about to hear is our first episode with Vin Diesel himself. But in order to hear future episodes, you gotta subscribe to EW's Binge, the Fast Saga feed.
Search for it wherever you get your podcasts.
And now, on with the show.
We're sitting on the floor of this airport, bags to the side, legs stretched out, people, thousands of people walking by, walking over us, walking over our leg. And he looks at, now he had already had some films out, so he was kind of a little more familiar with what was to come. And he said, you know, Vin, take all this in. Take in the fact that all these people are just walking by us. And I said, why? And he said, because when this movie comes out, our anonymity will be gone.
Ask any podcaster, any real podcaster. It doesn't matter if you record in person or over video chat. Podcasting's podcasting. Welcome to EW's Binge of the Fast Saga, full transcripts of which are available on EW.com. I'm Derek Lawrence, aka the guy who went as Dominic Toretto for two straight Halloweens. And as that icon once said, the most important thing in life will always be the people in this Zoom, right here, right now. And for me, that's the Dom to my Brian, the Letty to my Mia, the Roman to my Tej, the Giselle to my Han, Chanel Berlin Johnson. Chanel, are you ready to relive Fast and Furious one film at a time?
Oh, I'm so ready. I feel like for both of us, probably been waiting our whole lives for an excuse to do something like this. And now it's here and I'm ready to dive in and talk about each movie in depth with all the players.
This is like a dream come true. You know, I feel like people can tell we're just beaming with excitement to finally start this. Now, you know, people might be asking, you know, why are we doing this? Like what's the occasion? Well, first off, you must not know us very well if you just asked that question. Because like I said,
any day.
Yes, absolutely. These are, if we were still in the office, we'd be having these conversations every day. We're having them over Slack. So this is just two friends getting to talk fast with the Fast family. Now, I mean, you mentioned this is like, we've been waiting a long time, maybe our whole lives, but definitely like me, I first like came up with this idea for hopefully that EW could do this like 4 years ago. And we were finally ready to roll last March. We were literally one day away from recording our first interview in the office. These were going to be in person. I was so hyped. And then, well, I think you could figure out why that didn't happen. But we are obsessed with these movies, as we've probably just displayed now, and will be on full display throughout this whole series. But more importantly, we're celebrating 20 years of Fast and Furious this June, as well as the release of the highly anticipated and space-bound F9. Yes. It's happening. That means a lot of things are happening. F9's happening. Yeah. We've been waiting. We were still in the office when that trailer dropped, that first trailer. Mm-hmm. And I still remember my reaction to it. They had a big, premiere for it at the Super Bowl in Miami, when we could still go to events. And I was watching the live stream. I had my headphones in. I'm sitting there. First, John Cena, they reveal John Cena is playing Jacob Toretto, Dom's brother. I think I laughed. I literally laughed so hard. I was just like, oh my God, are they really doing that? It's awesome.
Yeah.
And then they did the big jump, like the, you know, Indiana Jones style, like island, whatever we want to call that. And I was like, I think I like jumped out of my seat a little bit. And I was like, oh man, that was a roller coaster. They just gave us 4 minutes. Wow. And then
you realize. Oh my God.
Han alive. And I think I screamed out loud. And like I said, I don't really know. I'm just locked in on this. So that finally ends. I put down my headphones. I look around. The whole office is staring at me. They don't know what was just going on. And I'm just yelling justice for Han around the office. Unfortunately, we in the office, we didn't sit next to each other. So you're probably doing the same thing way on the other side, right?
Yes, absolutely. I feel it's just surprise after surprise in that first trailer, which is amazing that they can still do that for us, even, you know, this deep into it. who could have anticipated Han coming back the way he did? I'm so excited.
Yeah. And so we've teased it a little bit here, but it goes without saying that we don't have friends, Chanel. We have family, but right. we have the actual Fast and Furious family. Starting with this debut episode, we'll be going through each Fast film with one of its stars or a behind the scenes star in the case of director Justin Lin. And when I say stars, I mean these stars. Like,
yes.
The competition is going to be so furious with how stacked this lineup is. We've got Michelle Rodriguez, Sung Kang, Ludacris, Jordana Brewster, Tyrese, Lucas Black, Natalie Emmanuel, Jacob Toretto, aka yes. John Cena. But today, to talk about the one that started it all, it's Toretto, Chanel. It's always been Toretto. Yes, Vin Diesel is here to go deep on 2001's The Fast and the Furious. Still a classic, no matter how different it is from what we've come to know Fast to be now. But before we dive into our chat with Vin, who was great, he gave us a lot of time, a lot of incredible information that I had never heard before. But what should people know about that first movie?
Yeah, well, hopefully everybody listening to this has watched all of the movies and are just as obsessed as us. But if you need a little refresher, because you haven't seen it in a while, of course, you know, you'll see the gang come together, sort of the origin story for all of it now. Well, we have Brian, of course, new to town, undercover cop. Well, not new to town, undercover cop. And he's trying to investigate what's going on with this crew, these thefts, and gets kind of caught up in the fast world and falls in love with them, essentially. Like, it's truly kind of a love story, but it's not just about, obviously there's the main with Mia, but it's about the whole crew and everything they do together. He just dives right in. And of course, as you know, at the end, even sort of forsakes his life as a cop because he is all about the family now, just like us. That's how we all feel at the end of the movie. So I can't wait to get into it and talk about it with Vin and and revisit all of the stuff that we loved about it and learn things we didn't know before.
Yeah, you're really right about that first film. Brian really was, was the audience avatar. Like, he was entering this world, we were entering this world that we didn't know anything about. I mean, he also felt like my personal avatar. I remember we had this, again, speaks to how obsessed I am with these movies. When EW, a bunch of our coworkers moved out from New York to LA a couple years ago, and kind of as a bonding thing, I found out a lot of them had never seen a Fast and Furious film, which was like a personal affront to me. And so I was like, invited a bunch of people over. We were like, all right, we're going to binge these. We did the first one. And I remember realizing that Paul Walker's character was going by the name Brian Spillner. And his fake ID said he's from Tucson, Arizona. And I was like, wait. I'm from Tucson, Arizona. I used to live in Tucson, Arizona. And then I was like, I have blue eyes. Paul, like, Brian has blue eyes. I was like, am I Brian? So like, that's how deep I got sucked into it. But enough about me and my comparison of myself to Brian. We do make sure though to stay tuned after we're done with Vin, because Chanel and I will be hopping back on to have a bit more fun with Fast One and hand out some awards. I mean, we all know Fast deserves some awards, love, so we're here to do that. But I've learned it's not how you talk about your interview, it's how you conduct your interview. Yes. So let's get into it. Here's Fast Patriarch Vin Diesel.
What the hell's going on around here?
Street's closed, pizza boy. Find another way home.
Goddamn street racers.
Ask any podcaster, any real podcaster. It doesn't matter if you talk to Vin Diesel for a minute or an hour. Winning's winning. And we're the true victors today because we're joined by Dominic Toretto himself, the one and only Vin Diesel. Vin, welcome to our binge of Fast and Furious.
Pleasure to be here. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I mean, it's we had to start with you for the first film. I mean, this is, you know, truly a classic. 20 years of Fast. I can't believe that. So it's we're really excited to start with you on this first film.
My God, 20 years ago, from the very weekend that the first Fast and Furious opened, so many memories, so many wonderful, wonderful. Wonderful memories surrounding that time in my life when this movie was finally coming out. I remember it was supposed to come out in March, and I had gotten a call saying that they wanted to move it to June. And I was like, but I've been waiting for this movie to come out in March. And they said, no, then that's a good thing that they're moving it to the summer. Of course, it was it.
Yeah.
I love the symmetry now. Like you said, you know, it's meant to be. Obviously, we would have loved to see F9 last year, but the fact that it's, you know, going to essentially be 20 years on the dot, that was kind of feels meant to be.
Mm-hmm. It does feel meant to be. It not only feels meant to be, again, similar situation. Last year, I thought it was going to come out in May. I was excited. I told all the fans, and we had to push it a year. But who would have thought last year it would have been a blockbuster release because it's F9. This year, it's a call back to that theatrical experience. Mm-hmm. That theatrical experience we have all missed, and we don't realize how much we've missed. We've been entertained and watching movies on our couch. And we forgot that explosive electric feeling of being in a theater as an audience, as one, as a community, engaged in this spectacle. And you never know how much you miss something until it's gone. And so it's I'm really proud that Universal is willing to be that blockbuster that comes in and says, let's get back to the movies together.
Yes.
We need it. We need it.
We need it. We really need it.
Yeah.
Of all these interviews, we start by quoting a great man's words. You know, I live my life a quarter mile at a time. Nothing else matters. For those 10 seconds or less, I'm free. So this is a challenge, but how would you sum up this first Fast film in 10 seconds?
I live my life a quarter mile at a time.
That is truly perfect. I can't think of a better way to do it.
I remember actually the studio head, I think a few years back, said commented on that scene and said, if that scene was a tricky scene then. And he said, you know, some actors might not have been able to pull that off. And if it didn't work, the whole franchise never would have worked. It was that moment that cemented the Fast and Furious into pop culture and then making it the world saga.
Yeah, it is. It's like the moment where you get the heart, not for the first time, but where it really sinks in, and it's perfect.
It's so true. And what's so exciting about F9 is we revisit that moment from a different perspective.
Ooh.
Oh, that's exciting.
That's a tease. That's an A+ tease right there. That's, oh my gosh. That, I mean, yeah, I don't want to jump in, but that scene, I had written down to ask you about that scene because I'll admit it. So I had a Fast watch party a couple years ago. A few people that I knew hadn't seen them. I'm like, we're changing this. We're watching Fast 1 and going through them all. And that scene came on. And first, you know, obviously Paul's incredible kicking it off with his kind of like, I almost had you. And then you walk around the car. I literally said to everyone, I was like, this is movie star stuff right here. Like, this is this right here. So like when you see a scene like that on paper, are you just like kind of salivating as like knowing, you know, the potential of what you can do with something like that?
I was so excited by that scene. It was in some ways the biggest scene that we had in the movie because there were the most people around. And the people that were in the scene were real illegal streetcar racers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they were feeding with such authentic energy that it made it so much easier for Paul and I to delve into the scene and really rip it apart. We were lucky. We had started before production prepping for that scene. So one of the things that we did as actors in preparation for that scene was we did go to illegal streetcar races. Now, I grew up in New York City. And in New York City, in Manhattan, you won't see a lot of helicopters. And you definitely won't see helicopters disperse anything, like any kind of illegal streetcar racing. That's not going to happen. But Paul grew up in LA and was accustomed to helicopters breaking up illegal streetcar races. And I wasn't. So I remember when the helicopters came, I'm like, well, which way do you run? And I have this image of Paul and I running over this bridge. Now, we haven't even filmed the movie yet. So we really don't, you know, we're really putting ourselves out there.
Yeah.
I'm one of the illegal streetcar racers, all great people that ended up forming this, like, you know, legal form of these races, said, get in, get in. And very similar to the scene of Brian saying, get in to Dom when he's running in East LA. Yeah, it's all those memories, the memories of going to Cuba to better prepare for the character because he owned a Cuba bodega. Yeah. all the, you know, that was the time when I had all the time in the world to prepare like crazy for every single role. But yeah, that'll always stay with me. So that scene that you mentioned where I go, you almost had me, there was a lot that led up to that.
Yeah.
And again, it was the crowd there that was so electric, so appropriately authentic that added to that. What are you smiling about?
Dude, I almost had you.
You almost had me? You never had me. You never had your car. Granny shifting, not double clutching like you should. You're lucky that 100 shot of NOS didn't blow the welds on the intake. Almost had me? Now me and the mad scientist gotta rip apart the block and replace the piston rings you fried. Ask any racer, any real racer. It don't matter if you win by an inch or a mile. Winning's winning.
Take us back to Fast coming into your life and your initial reaction. I know it took a little bit of convincing. You were kind of like all in, and then you were kind of like, I don't know about this. So kind of take me back through that process.
Oh, yeah. No one would ever think that. You have to understand. So if I've come into this industry, if I'm acting since I'm 7 years old and I can't get a role and I can't break. And I then go to independent film and become a director and a writer and a producer and do a short film and then do a feature film and go to Cannes with the short and then Sundance with the feature. I'm very precious about trying to do the best work possible at all costs. And so when I was given the script, because Universal, I know this sounds crazy, but Universal ended up releasing or being involved in the release of Pitch Black. Mm. And that was the only other movie I had done of that size. And so they said, we got this movie that's about illegal streetcar racing. And we want you to play this character, Dom. Who's a tough guy, outlaw with a heart and a code. Okay. And then they describe that scene that you see in the first movie where the camera goes through my eye and down my arm and into the engine. And that's the only thing they described. And I said, yes, I'm in. The next day I'm supposed to go to the premiere in Australia, I believe, for Pitch Black. And I read the script and I go,
maybe not.
And my father, who is such an important person in my life, is such a purist about art that I got that from him. And so, you know, we grew up in an artist housing in New York City, where if you made more than $10,000 a year, you were kicked out of the building. We were like, we're real artists. And so I'm conflicted here because this script is not what I thought it would be. They hire David Ayer. Mm-hmm. That day, they asked me to come in and we do a page by page, critique/rewrite. And David Ayer goes off and writes this great script and the rest is history.
When do you feel like you really got Dom? Was it during that process of going through the rewrites with David Ayer, or was it later? When do you feel like you really were like, okay, this is it?
Great question. Great, great question. I had felt like I had gotten, the irony is I felt like I had gotten what the character wanted to be in the first script, but I felt that there were things conflicting with his truth. And that's where David Ayer came in. And he said, I remember him saying, the Dom character is so complex. I've never seen anything like it since Alfonso, when Denzel played Alfonso for him. And so I kind of appreciated that he had kind of was able to see the complexities of the character and to start kind of, I'm sure he didn't imagine we'd be 20 years later releasing Fast 9 and exploring more of this Dom character. I'm sure he didn't. Yeah, so I got the world and what the world was about, but the character just needed some fine tuning, and some other characters needed some fine tuning as well, like the Letty character, across the board. And I'm just so lucky that they were open to it all, and that they really wanted me to feel great about it and confident about it. And that's not the normal Hollywood story, but my Hollywood story has never been the normal Hollywood story. You know, being an actor in the 80s and the 90s as a multicultural actor, there weren't a whole lot of opportunities, which is why I ended up doing my own films like Multifacial. I don't know if you've ever seen Multifacial.
Yep, absolutely.
But the idea that I went down that road, and then this industry that I had been begging to be a part of for two decades, more than two decades, finally comes and says, we're not going to ask you to audition. We're going to write a role for you in Saving Private Ryan. And so nothing about my journey was typical, I guess. And I'm grateful for that, because it's allowed me to be that much more invested in the films that I've been lucky enough to be a part of.
Yeah. It just really shows, like, from the beginning, and you guys have always been great about, you know, everyone's listening to everyone, right? And, like, you know, any concerns, you're hearing it out, and, like, kind of shows that, you know, that can lead to some success.
That's my mantra. So we had done an interview yesterday, and they asked, do you still take notes from the studio? And I take notes from my stand-in. I take notes from the driver. I take notes from the nurse. I take notes from any human that will spend a second to think about this masterpiece we're trying to make. I take notes from my 5-year-old kid. I will take notes from anybody. I'm not precious.
Yeah. I'll sync up later with you for my ideas for wrapping up the franchise. We'll talk later. We'll talk later. So you're fully on board, and Paul was already signed on. You know, he had worked with Neil and Rob on the Skulls. So then, right. I mean, this movie doesn't work if that dynamic isn't right. Like, it just doesn't. So true. Yeah. So what was it like? You know, was that chemistry just instant there with Paul? Like, obviously, you know, you guys are off going to street races, so clearly you got along pretty good from the beginning.
We got along clearly from the beginning. I first met him at Dodger Stadium. We were testing out our cars. Part of the process of Fast is we've always auditioned our cars. So the cars have been such a significant part and representation of our characters that there is a process of casting, right? Of casting the exact vehicle for the state of mind that the character's in, or the journey that the character's going through. But would you go back to that time? We're just coming out of the East Coast, West Coast beef. Yeah. If you can remember where you are, 1999, this is not common for a New Yorker and a West Coast to kind of find common ground, which in some ways lends itself to each character's journey and the relationship and the objective of finding that brotherhood. It's no one would ever associate that, but we were just coming from, it was still popular that there was a divide. We were still getting over the deaths of Tupac and Biggie and it was still very much present in our lives. There was that. So when I came on, it was me and my New York crew and him and his West Coast crew, and to see that brotherhood form added something special to the movie.
Had you been familiar with Paul's work before this movie at all? Like, had you seen him in other stuff, or the first time you met him was kind of the first time you saw him?
No, I saw him in Skulls, and I thought it was incredible. I had seen him. I had seen his work, and I. When I met him, that was a whole nother level, because I saw an authenticity that was just right for the movie industry. Just prime for something like this. He, through the years, has always been the one with that that's helped. While I'm off thinking about story, or while I'm off thinking about stunts and casting and dynamics and how to realize the impossible, he would often cover us by, you know, owning automotive shops, doing races, actually becoming a racer, a streetcar racer, and then actually running on the track. And he would do that to contribute to the legitimacy of, that's what's in some ways so hard about when he left us, because in some ways, and I know this isn't, this interview is not supposed to go that way, but, he was doing a fundraiser at a garage where he was collecting cars, and bless him.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, like I said, with doing that oral history, anybody I talked to, I didn't even have to bring up Paul. They would and just, you know, say nothing but, you know, beautiful things. So, You know, we miss him. And what as important as we talked about that relationship, it was obviously you and Michelle, you know, portraying a very different relationship with Dom and Letty. And, you know, that has just kept on going and become one of, you know, the most recognized, you know, couples in film history, I dare to say. But talking to her, she said it was funny early on, because, you know, you talked about you come from this very, you know, actor, you know, professional actor realm. And she's like, she literally said to me, I'm just this crazy girl from Jersey City on her second movie. So what was it like kind of early on, you guys kind of working out this, you know, obviously this now legendary chemistry between you two?
One of the things I was working with David Ayer on was kind of her character as well, because she was from East Coast as well, and she kind of represented where we were from. And, you know, as a minority, you want to, that wasn't common in cinema. If you imagine 20 years ago in the 90s that Michelle Rodriguez would be this iconic figure that represents a love in cinema like we have never seen before, you would say, well, you would pick a million other actors, but there is no actor in Hollywood that could boast of a love like Michelle Rodriguez. No one has that. No one's done garnered billions of people and audiences around the world that want to ride or die in the way that a Letty character does. Wants to, that's an iconic. And something we didn't realize, but when I think about it and I go back to the first movie, maybe subconsciously there was that dream that would be our world's love story. These kind of, non-typical, Hollywood types would be the ones. And it was a contrast, a deliberate contrast between the Brian and Mia relationship. The Brian and Mia relationship was more conventional, and the relationship between Dom and Letty was not conventional, and they weren't perfect. And somehow, right when the turn of the millennium, the audience started to lean into that as a representation of what relationships might be in the new millennium.
That is definitely something that stuck out to me. I remember I was 14, I think, when the first movie came out. And so, you know, that blew my mind just to see both Michelle and Jordana, like, in those roles as these leading women. And it's even rewatching it, it's still cool to me that, like, yeah, Letty's involved in the heists and everything like that, too. Right. As you evolved that relationship, like Michelle says that she kind of leaves sort of the romantic arc to you to help guide her, and then she's just like down the ride. But what are those conversations like as you're sort of figuring out those beats for Dom and Letty?
I didn't read a lot of reviews, but I heard all the reviews were good from the first one.
Yeah.
And then someone said, I forgot where it was, New York Times or something. Someone said the only crime of Fast and the Furious is we didn't get to explore enough of Dom and Letty. And maybe I've kept that in the back of my head. But after the fourth one, when her character was written out of the movie, I mean, I can remember right to, I was already saying she will have to be in the movie. Letty will have to be in this mythology in order for us or me or all of us to, construct the next trilogy. Mm-hmm. You will need this archetype. This archetype will be needed for this mythology to progress. And it's been, if you really think about it, you know, you go through four, avenging Letty. That brings Dom back.
Yeah.
Right? And then when you go to five, you end with, when you go to five, Ilsa Pataki's character is trying to fill in for Letty. And then you realize how much he's misses his true soulmate.
Yeah.
And then at the end of five, Eva Mendes comes in and goes, do you believe in ghosts?
Best moment.
Which, I mean, if we're taking notes, I'll take Eva Mendes back. If we're just like throwing in little notes. No.
Just wait for 10.
Oh, let's go.
Let's just say the fact that you guys know that the studio is saying we can't cover all this ground that needs to be covered in just one movie. You can only imagine what is to come.
Yeah.
Oh man. Ooh. Oh, getting me excited just talking to you about it.
So much packed in.
You know, obviously filming on a Fast 1 is so different from filming on an F9. Like, you know, not even apart from the budgets or the stakes on screen, just like you guys were so under the radar on that first one. So what was it like thinking back on that? You know, we're talking summer 2000. You guys are just, you know, running around LA, going to street races, you know, having a good time.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Amazing. I often tell this story because after we made the movie, we went to, I don't know if you remember MTV Spring Break.
Yeah.
We went to Mexico for MTV Spring Break. And I remember we had to like circle around. We couldn't go to an airport. The plane was about to, whatever. Anyway, but on our way home, we just wanted to go back commercial because we didn't feel too comfortable. Paul and I, right? So Paul and I are, I will never forget this. We're sitting on the floor of this airport, bags to the side, legs stretched out, people, thousands of people walking by, walking over us, walking over our leg. And he looks at, now he had already had some films out. So he was kind of a little more familiar with what was to come. And he said, you know, Vin, take all this in. Take in the fact that all these people are just walking by us. And I said, why? And he said, because when this movie comes out, our anonymity will be gone. And it was so telling. And it was it was surreal. It was surreal.
He knew.
How he knew something. And I was always in the making. And that's where my mind was. I had just come from directing movies and writing movies. So, but he had this ability to see. It's like, you know, he would always say, every time we'd come out of a movie, every time we'd come out of a premiere, he'd always say, It would just be me and him for whatever movie it was. Everyone would be, the studio would be away from us, and the cast and the crew, and everybody would always give us our moment. And he'd always say, "Ben, the best one's still in the can."
Oh, man!
You didn't hear the ball! They're going crazy! What do you mean the best one's still in the can?
I can't imagine walking out of Fast Five and thinking like, oh man, there's we're gonna top this one. Like, man, the confidence that that takes. I love it. I love that.
Oh my God, it was just so funny. It was just, and like clockwork every time. Darn it, Paul.
Is it wild to think back, like, obviously in recent movies, like, we have everything from flying cars to a nuclear submarine. Is it, like, wild when you sit there and think back, like, this started with hijacking some DVD players, like, which is, like, such a 2001 thing. But it's, like, quite the origin story of DVD players.
It is. It totally started at a different place. And it started very humble. And I guess that's something that I'm grateful for, that we were able to start from humble beginnings so that you could really connect with these characters without all the spectacle. The spectacle came as the movies needed to start one-upping themselves. And as the audience started to expect the unexpected, and they would want to, you go to see Fast and you see that in a theater for good reason. Because you know you're going to go, something they don't teach in film school. They teach you, and in every writing, script writing class, they teach you all kinds of how to draw emotion, how to create, you know, different archetypes. But nobody teaches you how to create the feeling. And that feeling is what Fast is.
Did the first script have that moment for you where you were like, oh my God, like, this is insane?
That first script did have that moment. That first script, when the car goes over, flips over.
Yeah.
That was done practical. So you can only imagine how, yeah. I mean, if it was done practical, it meant that it had to be done practical. There was no digital option.
Right.
There was no CGI option. So you can only imagine when I saw that, I was like, oh my God.
We've got to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Welcome back. Let's jump back into the interview.
We're obviously now, you know, 9 films in, you know, 2 more to go, which is like all that. I mean, that's wild to think, just, you know, regardless of anything. But the fact is, like, too, who would have guessed that when, you know, you obviously opted, you know, not to return originally. And, you know, this is something we talked about, you know, when Bloodshot was coming out, we talked about how to kind of your mindset of world building. You know, you've done it with so many different franchises, Riddick, you know, Fast, Triple X. But you know, what was the thought process there going back? I know you originally said you asked Universal not to make a sequel because you thought it would ruin the ability for that first one to be a classic, which I'm thankful that that was not the case. we could report that it's still a classic 9 movies later. So what was that thought process like just for you originally back, you know, then after the success of the first one?
Well, I was a fan of classics. So Rebel Without a Cause, Wild on the Waterfront, or like older movies that were classics. And I had seen movies get sequelized, and quite often studios would just brand the movie. So they would slap the title, and they weren't trying to Francis Ford Coppola the movie. They weren't trying to go that extra level to make sure that you were building off of the existing story and the existing characters and having those characters evolve. you just simply call it a whatever the brand thing is, and not evolve the story in an episodic fashion. So that's why I said, guys, if you do another one, you're going to jeopardize this first one being a classic. And of course, script was always something very important to me. So if I didn't feel comfortable with the script, I was crazy enough to turn down offers that, you know, I remember turning down the offer for Too Fast, Too Furious. And my father, who I just said is this incredible, altruistic, pure artist, you sure you want to do that, son? I thought he was going to say, oh, I'm glad you can't be bought. I love that. That's amazing. And he flipped it on me and said, you sure you want to? But by doing that, you send a message with your actions that you have to continue with integrity. So if I didn't opt out of being in the second one, I never would have been able to be in a position to become the producer and to have such a incredible role in the thinking. I remember when I did the fourth one, the roles now had reversed. I was saying, you know what? I see so far into this mythology. You could save a lot of money if you just film 4 and 5 together. And they almost kicked me off the Universal lot.
Like, calm down, man. Calm down.
Get out of here. You're lucky we're even making a Fast 4. I'm sorry.
I mean, very important question. How many films do you think we would have gotten if the original title of Red Line had stuck? Like, two red, two line doesn't really have the same ring to it.
No.
I don't know. What do you think? Could we have been, or would we be sitting here with Red Line?
Yeah, that's another thing that's around that. It was called Red Line, and I wanted to keep Red Line, and because I've been thinking Red Line, right?
Yeah.
And it was Neil Moritz who called me and said, I got the title. And this was after, right before we were about to open the movie. So around that time when I shared with you that they were moving the date to the summer, and I didn't understand what that meant. And I thought, will this movie ever come out?
Yeah.
Please come on. I was like, I didn't know anything about dating movies. And so at that time, there was another call from Neil Moritz where he said, I got the title. I think it should be The Fast and the Furious. And then it just grew on me.
Yeah, at first you're like, wait, so you want to push my movie a couple months and change the title? What is going on here?
Because, you know, I had the big dreams when I went to Sundance. You know, when I went to Sundance a couple of years earlier, we had heard all this about films going to Sundance and selling for all this money and getting picked up and getting distributed. And mine didn't get distributed. So there was always that fear, like, if you push it, are you going to shelve this movie? Is anyone ever going to see it? So that coupled with name change, you could see how you could be.
Yeah. Some worries there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then we'll wrap up with what we're calling the finish line, a kind of rapid fire questions about the film and the franchise. So I guess I would, The first question, this idea came for me because of you being in Tokyo Drift, like you getting dropped in, especially after they had already filmed the movie and then they drop you in. So say we have a time machine and we could go back and add someone to this first Fast movie. We're not replacing anybody, but we're adding, maybe it's someone who came in a Fast film later or just an actor you think would have been a great fit. Like who are we going in the time machine and putting in Fast 1?
That has never been in the franchise or has
either
been
one. Either one, whatever feels right.
I guess if I were to think, where we're going with the next chapter. And Michael Caine, I might have found a way. If I, you're saying if I could have redesigned the mythology or added little elements to the mythology, I could have done something with Helen Mirren and Michael Caine's character and played something out. I could have introduced something in the future.
That would have been amazing.
We're not giving up on that. Yeah. We still got a few films to make that to make that happen. Then each episode we have what we're calling Derek's embarrassing story of the week, where I kind of maybe they're not embarrassing, but it really shows my fandom. And usually we just have one, but I have a few for this one, so I'm going to let you pick which is the most embarrassing Derek story of the week here. So we'll start number one. I went as Dom for two straight Halloweens, not just one, two straight Halloweens. Maybe, you know, we'll see. Maybe they'll add in the photo in post, and the people will get to see that.
Amazing.
So
that's the best. It can't be.
I don't know. Hold on.
All right.
So last March, it was like the 30th day of, you know, where the world shut down. We're in quarantine. I decided to take a drive over to the Toretto house. I had always wanted to go. I went over and I walked. I checked out the Toretto house, and then I walked down the street to the Toretto shop, which I did not realize was right so down the close. Street. I did not realize that. So, and I walked in and bought a Corona. Of course, I had to do it. So that's
so awesome.
That's number
so
two.
Awesome.
We got two more covered, so we might still top these.
Oh, okay, that was awesome.
Number three, my parents came to visit a few years ago. We're driving down the PCH. We drive past Neptune's net, and I'm like, that looks familiar. And then I immediately was like, fast one, Dom, Brian, meal there. Let's go eat.
We go eat. So many memories.
We not only do we go eat, my stepmom happily recreates the shot of you and Paul sitting there, like leaning over the table. And that is one of my most prized possessions.
That's so awesome.
And then lastly, I'm wearing a Toretto shirt. So that's number four. So we'll let you, what's the story there? Whether it's most embarrassing, whatever is your favorite of those four?
The most embarrassing of two Halloweens.
Who repeats a costume? That's fair.
At least
face it out. I know. I deserve that.
That's awesome. No, that's they're all, by the way, Derek, they're all wonderful stories. And that's why I always enjoy talking to you about this franchise, because you appreciate it. And that makes all of the efforts, all the hard work, all the perilous stunts and action sequences that myself and my amazing stunt team always do, it makes it all count. And I appreciate that.
I appreciate you for allowing me to have a costume to dress up in two times a year.
Why did I think of that? You know how many years I've gone not knowing what to wear, not knowing what to be? What am I thinking? Yeah. It's right there. It's staring at me in the mirror.
Wrapping up, kind of we've talked around F9 a little bit, but what would be your... maybe tease when we're finally back in theaters, might be the most anticipated movie of all time, at least for me. I'm biased, but yes. But what would be your F9 tease for all the fans out there that have been patiently waiting?
There's so much good stuff. I would say that if the whole world has this kind of excitement about this movie coming out, but for those that have been with the franchise, it's even more special, because if you could remember the first movie, you are now going to go, you're going to go before the first movie and understand the first movie even more. I don't know if that's I'm saying that's cool stuff. If you're, I'm a D&D head, so that's like origin stuff is just. To see family members you never thought you would have seen is gonna kind of blow your mind.
Oh,
that's beautiful.
To see the we've been wanting to know what poetry has where was Dom before he became Dom? Like what who was his influences? What was, that's going to be really rich with story and a lot of fun to see.
That's
really yeah.
Nah. Yeah. I love that too, because that makes me, my first thing that came to my mind was that Fast Five scene with you and Paul on the balcony talking about your dads, you know, so so yeah, no, I'd love to hear that maybe we'll get a little peek back.
Yeah, I was also thinking too that there's so many callbacks in other movies. So one of the things I wanted to ask you was like, what's something that you'd love to be able to bring back? But it sounds like the best is yet to come there.
The best is yet to come. As Paul would say.
That's what I was gonna say. The best one's still in the can. Always. You're gonna do the last one, and you're still gonna be thinking that in the back of your head. You'll be like, but Paul said the best one's still in the can.
I will always think that. That will always be and bless him for that. And bless him for adding that momentum, that motivation to always reach higher and making it something that has reverence and significance and reminding us all to never rest on our laurels, but to earn every part of it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I know the second trailer will be out by the time people hear this. And I know there's a little Paul, you know, nod we get in that. So I think we're all excited to see that bit of it too. Vin, I'm glad we didn't just almost have you. We actually had you. So hopefully we earned your respect. And thanks for becoming a part of the Binge family. We Thank always you. Love to talk always. To you.
Thank you guys so much for having me. I really appreciate it. Love, guys. Love.
Yeah, right back at you, Vin. Thank you.
I live my life a quarter mile at a time. Nothing else matters, not the mortgage, not the store, not my team and all their bullshit. For those 10 seconds or less, I'm free.
All right, thank you so much to Vin Diesel for letting us climb in the ring with Ali. But we love these movies so much that we couldn't go without talking more about them. So, considering the snobs at the Oscars and Golden Globes refuse to recognize Fast's greatness, we're bringing some justice and handing out a few awards.
As Brian said in Fast 1, if I win, I take the money and the respect. To some people, that's more important. Well, while he eventually won Dom's respect, we have to decide now who won our respects. What are you saying for this one, Derek?
I mean, and as we've talked about these awards, I feel like there's a lot of different ways you can go. You can pick a character. You know, could it be Brian? Mm-hmm. You know, he earned Dom's respect. Did he earn our respect? Could it be an actor in it? And I think that's the direction I wanted to go in, which was Paul Walker. And like, we'll talk a lot about Paul Walker throughout this whole Binge series, but he is so good in this first movie. Him and Vin are both incredible, and we'll get further into Vin as well. But he, like you said at the top, he's the avatar into this. And if we're not invested in him, we're not invested in any of this. And Paul Walker, we should say, Paul Walker was definitely someone that was known. He wasn't a star, I would say, but he had he had been working a long time. But I don't know that we knew he had this in him. He had done, you know, he had been on a soap opera. He had done movies such as Varsity Blues, She's All That. He did The Skulls right before this, which that was like kind of the origin story of Fast, because he was working on The Skulls with director Rob Cohen and producer Neil Moritz, and they all ended up doing Fast together. But I think this really kind of changed the direction of his career. And for talking to everyone, and you know, spoiler alert for our interviews, you know, to come, everyone has such incredible things to say about him, but mostly just as a person. And, you know, he wasn't really locked in on these, you know, on the industry. He had so many more interests outside of it. But I just feel like we had to say how incredible Paul is throughout these movies, but especially in this first one. We have an award coming up later that won't go to him, but easily could have. So I felt like he earned that respect here. And, you know, rest in peace, obviously. And, you know, we can't wait to keep talking about him throughout this series.
I totally agree with that. Two things about it. Like, one, it's a new role for him, like a new type of, he'd been sort of like a side character and other things. And like, I knew his face, but this is in a way like his first real leading man kind of role. And if we don't believe him, like the movie falls apart, because he has to be both like charming enough to want to make the audience want him to like be accepted by the crew, but at the same time, like also apart from them enough that we believe sort of the depth of that betrayal and stuff as well. And he pulls off both. I want him to go on the run with Vin Diesel by the end of this movie.
Yeah. Speaking to producer Neil Moritz, he said, he's like, Paul just had this thing. He's like, women wanted to be with him, guys wanted to be him. And like, obviously that's a thing that, you know, that's, he didn't make up that phrase. That's definitely been out there about, you know, you could say that about a lot of people, but like, I think when I heard him say that about Paul, that he's like, that's spot on. Like he really,
yeah.
But he also just talking to anyone. I remember talking to Gabrielle Union a few years ago about her experience with Paul on She's All That. And he just was like, he was the, you know, the most fun guy and, you know, the nicest guy. And obviously a great actor as well. So
yeah.
All the respect to Paul, winner of this category. Next up, we've got, hey, this guy is in the movie. You know, we talk about all, you know, we're going to talk so much about Paul Walker, Vin Diesel, Michelle Rodriguez, Jordana Brewster, but we like to shout out the, you know, maybe the one-offs, the supporting players, the, you know, maybe someone that hadn't really achieved star status and you look back and you're like, oh my God, they were in this. For this one, it was Ted Levine. It was always Ted Levine. Buffalo Bill himself. And I just can't believe that he's in this movie. And it's always fun to go back and realize that he was.
Yeah, absolutely. The energy is so different in this movie that I think, especially because, you know, when this movie came out, the first time I saw it, I'm not thinking about it like that. So it's like subsequent viewings of the movie later. It's like, oh, right, that is Buffalo Bill. So wild.
Yeah, definitely on the opposite end of the spectrum of his performance in Silence of the Lambs, which is good. I don't know that would have fit in this one.
It's also kind of funny, I just realized there is a line, he's not around for it, but there's the line when Dom looks at the ID for Brian and he says, Brian Earl Spilner, that sounds like a serial killer. Are you serious? Like, it's kind of a nugget in there that's pretty funny considering who else is in the film.
Wait, are you saying that Buffalo Bill somehow infiltrated the LAPD? And he was like, you know what, this is gonna be my little tip of the hat. I'm going to give this young undercover cop a serial killer name. This is how I'm going to still have that ability in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
I like that theory.
Brian Earl Spilner. Sounds like a serial killer name. Is that what you are?
No, man.
Next up, quote of the movie, and there's so many options on this one. Here's a few nominees, and then, Chanel, I'll let you pick a winner. We have Ja Rule. Shout out to Ja Rule. You know, there's going to be some maybe non-shout-outs to Ja Rule coming up, but he is, in his brief appearance in this movie, he is fun. You got to remember, Ja Rule's kind of really starting to blow up, you know, with his rap career at this time. He's got a great quote. It's not how you stand by your car, it's how you race your car. You better learn that.
And it's early in the movie, too.
Yeah, it's at that first race, and it's before, you know, it's when, it's a good scene. It's, you know, Paul Walker, Ja Rule. It's a fun one. So there you go, Ja. There's your shout out.
It's yours?
Yeah, I'm standing next to it.
That's funny. You know, everyone happens to know a few things. And one of the things everyone knows is, it's not how you stand by your car. It's how you race your car. You better learn that.
We have a classic. I live my life a quarter mile at a time. Dom.
Yeah. I mean,
what else has to be said about that one?
True.
And then our final nominee would be both Dom and Vince. Vince, there was a time when I didn't know you. That was in the third grade. it gets me every time. It gets me every time. And, you know, Vince gets a bad rap. Deservedly so. I'll say, you know, we don't have to defend everybody in the Fast and the Furious, but there's a fun little back and forth.
Yeah. I mean, I love the exchange between Vince and Dom, but you can't beat I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time. It's iconic. It's immediately, like, you think of the franchise and everything they've gone through. And also, like, looking back, especially in the scene that it comes up in, it's such a, an origin for the Dom character. And I feel like he's actually evolved from that line, but still it's so important to who he is.
You couldn't go any other way than that one.
Yep.
All right. The where are they now? So this is less of a reward and more of us trying to speculate on the life currently being lived by maybe a character we haven't seen in a long time. And I feel like there's an obvious one here, and it's not just some self-promotion on my part, but a few years ago, I tracked down Johnny Strong, who plays Leon in Fast One. And you may be asking, who is Leon? I don't remember a Leon. Well, Leon is the member of Dom's crew who loves to wear generic basketball jerseys and and yell at pizza delivery guys. So we know, sadly, Jesse dies in this movie. Mm-hmm. We thought Letty died, but she's back.
Yeah. Same with Han. So Jesse right now, like the only person, Jesse and Giselle, the only people who are like still definitely dead that we know of.
Also, Vince, he returned in Fast Five to get his little kind of moment, and then he dies mm-hmm. as well.
Yeah.
But Leon's the only original member of Dom's crew that we don't know what his whereabouts are. So like I said, I talked to Johnny Strong a few years ago. So you can go find that article over in the archives on EW.com. And he was a trip to talk to because he definitely he was talking about he has a lot of theories. He says, you know, they have that big final scene right before the truck jacking that goes bad. There's a little moment where like Leon's like, there's a little hesitation. He's like, are you sure we should be doing this? Like, it doesn't feel right, you know, to do it without Jesse. And so in his mind, in Johnny Strong's mind, he's like, oh, that's, you know, Leon had that doubt. So once the heat became too risky, he didn't want anything more to do with the gang. And I will say, speaking of heat, my favorite part of the interview is he compared Leon to Val Kilmer in Heat. Coincidentally, it's quite the heat check by Johnny Strong. Val Kilmer is iconic in Heat. Everything is iconic in Heat. So I just loved that he was like this Leon character that a lot of people probably don't remember his name. He would compare to Val Kilmer in Heat. But yeah. I don't know. What do you think? He had his own thoughts maybe on what Leon would be up to. I don't know. What do we think? Did he pass away at some point? Like, what is he still kicking around out there?
I like to think he's still out there. But the thing that I kind of can't decide is if he's out, I don't think he would betray them either. So I think it would be cool if at some point in the films they had to go to Leon for something. Like, he just has this one key thing that, you know, friend from way back who has this one resource and they need to go back to him. I just think he's like out there doing his thing, probably living like, you know, a legit life. Maybe if he was like, all right, actually stealing things, it's too hot for me.
Have you been speaking to Johnny Strong? Because I feel like that's what he wants. He basically was planting the seeds. He's like, he told me he'd only come back for the right situation. He made it seem like that he said that he would want like maybe Leon to be like the big bad that Dom has to go against, which I'm like, I don't know, man. They've been bringing in like Jason Statham, The Rock, and like Charlize Theron and John Cena. I don't know if you're, you know, quite got that that wattage for that. And he also,
but what I could see though is like it seems like from the trailer for F9, that Cypher is basically the one who taps Jacob. So I could see Cypher going after another person and be like, actually, I'm going to just turn all of the people you know against you.
maybe Jacob went down and tried to Leon. I don't know. All right. We'll have to stay tuned for F9. I can't wait to get that answer. All right. So I said at the top, no awards love has ever been given to Fast. They have not even been nominated for an Oscar. These films deserve some love. I mean, I won't say that they should be winning Oscars. I mean, I will say that. Save that for our Furious 7 episode, because See You Again, that should have been the lock of all locks for Best Original Song.
Yeah.
But each episode, we're going to decide what Oscar nomination that specific film should have had. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we're on the same page here.
Yeah.
What do we think here for Fast 1?
You have to give the Best Actor nomination to Vin Diesel. You have to do it. And I think it becomes actually more apparent in retrospect, because that scene where he's like, you know, he wants to show Brian something, and it's the car that eventually becomes for everybody like the iconic car. But the thing that you can kind of forget until you go back to watch it is I think might be the only time that Dom admits to being scared of something. And he's scared of this car and like what happened to his dad. And that scene is so emotional and sets up so much of who Dom really is. Like, we see the way he interacts with the crew. We see how Brian earns his respect, but we don't actually get to what his heart is until he sort of lays it all out in that scene. And he does such a good job. And if that scene doesn't work, the character doesn't work, the franchise can't continue, because then you don't really believe in like his code, what really matters to him. But he sells it and it's perfect and it's still golden 20 years later. So gotta be Vin Diesel.
Vin just so good in this first movie. Obviously his portrayal ends up is just iconic throughout, but this one, and this one, like you said, it's so different than any of the other ones. And it's, I would say, obviously it's not usually even this kind of movie, even it's lower stakes than what's to come. Not, right. It's not traditionally an Oscar type movie. I understand that. But 2002 Oscars, Denzel Washington wins Best Actor for Training Day. Mm-hmm. You can't tell me that Training Day is that much better a movie or that much different a movie than The Fast and the Furious 1.
Yeah.
Written by David Ayer, both of these.
Good point. Yeah, absolutely. So
the DNA is there, the shared DNA. And I mean, obviously, Denzel, I'm not going to say that like Denzel shouldn't have won the Oscar that year. I mean, he was incredible on Training Day. It's that performance still holds up. It's insane that it even took that long for him to get recognized as best actor.
Yeah.
But the precedent was set that kind of movie could get you in.
Yep, exactly.
And mm-hmm. I mean, I got the nominees pulled up, you know, so Denzel wins for Training Day, Russell Crowe nominated for A Beautiful Mind, Will Smith nominated for Ali. I mean, anybody who knows, I'm equally obsessed with Will Smith as I am Fast and Furious. So stay tuned for the binge Will Smith podcast coming soon.
Yeah.
We have Tom Wilkinson in the bedroom. I'll just admit, never seen it.
No.
This is the one that I take out. Sean Penn, I Am Sam. That aged terribly from the minute it happened.
Yeah.
So I think we just retroactively slot Vin in that Sean Penn slot and justice is served.
I think so, too. I completely agree. And you make a good point about them being similar types of movies. So, like, you could sneak Vin in there and give him his due because he does a great job. And I feel like in general, Vin Diesel doesn't get enough credit for his acting. And this is a movie, especially out of any in the franchise, that I think he really deserves that recognition.
Yeah, absolutely. Which plot line went by too fast? Chanel, what do you think?
It's got to be the Johnny Tran stuff, especially in retrospect. Like, it makes a lot of sense in the context of the movie, but it kind of also ends up being a little bit, with the exception of everything that happens with Jesse and stuff at the end, a little bit of a red herring because it's not really about the rivalry with Johnny Tran. It's not really about anything going on with that character. So that means we don't get to know a lot about him. The only time we see the people in his life that he does care about outside of just being sort of an antagonist in the movie is in a montage where nobody speaks. So I would love to dig into that a little more. Unfortunately, from the movie, it seems like Johnny Tran is dead. So there's no opportunity to go back and like see what he's doing now. But that is a person I would be curious to learn more about.
Did we ever get definitive on that? I feel like, again, it was a situation where, like, Brian's like, call an ambulance and then runs off.
Exactly. It's a little ambiguous.
Yeah. No, but you're totally right because, it almost is set up like, right? Like, Dom's actually more the big bad of that mm-hmm. first movie. So then that, unfortunately, that kind of slides Johnny Tran over a bit. But yeah, I feel like that there was a lot of potential. Rick Yoon, a really good actor, you know, who's done some good things. So I feel like he could have further developed that character if given the opportunity here in the film. So, I mean, nothing we can do about that now, but, you know, I definitely think there was more to be done with the Johnny Tran character. Totally agree.
Yeah.
The We Hungry Award, a little tip of the hat to Roman Pierce and Tyrese there. I just always love, we'll get into that on our Too Fast episode, but the way he said We Hungry every time gets me.
Perfect.
I feel like there could have been a few options. I don't know if it's, you know, technically counts as, you know, being hungry, but like when Dom and Brian come back to the house after the race gets busted up and Dom takes Vince's beer and gives it to Brian and Brian just like uses his shirt to wipe it off. Is so good. And just the look that Vince and Brian just looking at each other is perfect.
So
but I mean, the tuna sandwich, right? I mean, we got to give a shout out to the tuna sandwich. We haven't talked much about Jordana Brewster and the character of Mia, who obviously, as the movies go, she gets more to do in some and less to do in other films. But she was really winning in this film, I think. You get the appeal and you get why Brian would be drawn to her. I mean, still 20 years later, I as Dom asked, what did Mia put in that sandwich? I mean, we know it wasn't actually that good, apparently. You know, we've been told that. So I don't know. I wouldn't mind. I drove over during quarantine to the Toretto shop, and I was definitely bummed that there was no like tuna sandwiches for sale or anything like.
They have to.
Yeah, I bought a Corona, but there was no tuna. I would have loved to have that Corona with a tuna sandwich, but
it doesn't even have to be good, according to the movie.
Exactly. I mentioned we gave a shout out to Ja Rule earlier. Maybe, you know, Ja Rule, if you're listening, I mean, come on, if you are, please. I mean, we'll do a special episode with you, but. The Ja Rule mistake of the week. Now, for context, we have Ja Rule here in this first movie, and we'll get into this more in Too Fast. Ja Rule, I said he was kind of popping really at this time. He had the opportunity to come back for a bigger role in Too Fast. Mm-hmm. Turned it down, hence the award, the Ja Rule mistake of the week.
Yeah.
And this goes back to one earlier we'd say, like, it could be a plot mistake or a character mistake, anything like that. But I think we both landed on Vince basically sending Mia into Brian's arms, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And that was like the thing that he was so pressed about. And he ends up being the reason it happens in a way.
Yeah, for the context, you know, with everyone, obviously you've seen the film, I'm sure. But for your memory, if it's been a while, you know, Mia's kind of resistant, even though you could tell she's definitely into Brian.
There's some attraction.
Yeah, but she's like, I don't date my brother's friends, whatever. But then he, you know, after the barbecue, Brian's helping Mia with the dishes as the rest of the crew is watching a movie, and Vince comes in to microwave some popcorn, and he busts, Brian's chops about helping with the dishes. I would say bust chops is more of a friendly thing. So it's not even that. He's just outwardly like trying to make fun of him. And, but then that completely backfires. And, you know, Mia's like, oh, Vince, what was that place you wanted to go on a date to? And then he gets all excited and, you know, says it. I think it's cha-cha-cha's or something like that. And then, she's like, all right, Brian, so you'll take me there? And then, you know, Vince charges out. So it's like, man, maybe you would have kept your mouth shut, played the long game. I mean, I'm sorry, Vince. I don't think you were ever getting Mia, but, you know, maybe Brian wouldn't have gotten Mia either. So, just bad move. Even though we should point out, Vince was right in the end. He was right. He was right about Brian. He was right to be suspicious. So lose a point, gain a point for Vince.
Right. I think it's like one of those things like right, but also losing the long game. But he at least also gets to say that later on when he comes back. He's like, I was right and you didn't trust me then. So a little bit of justice for him as well.
Yeah, we're all about justice in this franchise, thankfully. Wrapping up, lastly, as we know, winning's winning. So Chanel, who was the ultimate winner of Fast 1?
I mean, we just said that Vin Diesel had to be nominated for an Oscar, so I think you can't really go with anybody else but him in this movie, both because of what it means for the franchise as a whole and, you know, how it kickstarts this amazing legacy now for the character and for Vin Diesel as a performer, but also just because in the movie, he's so cool and so interesting and, you know, he, alongside Mia, just the Toretto family, is the reason that Brian decides to basically change his entire life. So how could it be anybody else but Vin Diesel?
Yeah, I mean, it's ironic, right? You know, he doesn't return, obviously, for Too Fast, which we'll get more into next week. But, I mean, nobody has been a bigger winner out of the whole franchise than Vin Diesel. But no, you're totally right here. I mean, if we say a guy should be nominated for an Oscar, he probably won the film. And I mean, he won our interview too. I thought he was so great to talk to. He had some incredible stories. Such a fun interview. So thank you to Vin. Thank you, listeners. That's it for this episode. And like Brian O'Connor, we hope we earned your respect. In the meantime, please subscribe and listen along every week wherever you get your podcasts.
Rate us, share the show with your friends, tell us what you think. You can find us on Twitter at Derek J. Lawrence or me at Chanel Berlin.
Also, head to EW.com for complete coverage of the Fast Saga and full episode transcripts.
This episode was hosted and produced by Derek Lawrence and Chanel Berlin Johnson, produced, edited, and mixed by Sammy Junio, and executive produced by Carly Usden and Shayna Naomi Crockmo.
Thanks for listening, and until next time, salud, mi podcast familia.